On this week's 51%, we'll hear from the lead author on a study about Chinese comfort women.
My intention is not to see this issue as a politics between nation states. I think this fundamentally is an issue about human suffering.
And a medical student uses crowdfunding to help access clean water. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Pei Chu is the principal author of Chinese Comfort Women, Testimonies from Imperial Japan's Sex Slaves, a book that tells the stories of 12 victims during the time when the Japanese Imperial Army forced women and girls into sexual slavery in China. Chu is professor of Chinese and Japanese and director of the Asian Studies Program at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. She says it was while advising a student on a thesis about South Korean and Japanese comfort women that she decided it was time to do her part to tell the stories of Chinese comfort women. At first, Chu argued that with her expertise rooted in Chinese and Japanese literature, an historian would be better suited for the job, but she changed her mind. Given her ability to read Chinese, Japanese, and English, and the lack of English language publications on Chinese comfort women, she persevered despite being ill with Lyme disease.
I feel that a young American student could care about human suffering in a distant country at a time long before she was born. How could I say that, you know, this is not my field?
She says between her academic responsibilities and illness, it took about a decade to complete the book on Chinese comfort women.
This term comfort woman actually is a literal translation of a Japanese word pronounced yanfu. So yan means comfort and fu means women. It's not a term I like to use, but the book uses the term because over the years, during the international investigations and the debate, the term has become very well known. And the people, when you say comfort woman, they know this is referring to a specific time, a specific group of women who were forced into Japanese military comfort stations. The name comfort station is also translated from Japanese yanjo, which is the military-run brothels where women were confined and forced to service the soldiers, actually just subject them to repetitive rapes every day. And many also suffered torture, physical torture.
So this was World War II. Why the research now? What's the relevance today?
Yeah. There were report and literature, some kind of like memoirs in Japan, published in Japanese after the war. But it's not an issue that is known to the international community. But during the late 80s and the early 90s, the international human rights movement and the feminist movement brought this issue to the attention to the international community.
How were you able to get some of these women to tell their stories without fear of persecution or, you know, how were you able to do those?
That's a very good question. Actually, although we knew that it is a large number of victims in China, on mainland China today, you know, during decades after the war, these women were kept quiet. But Chinese researchers were inspired by the international redress movement and started investigation in early 1990s, a little bit later than the redress movement in Korea and Japan. My collaborating researcher, one of the co-authors, Professor Su, for example, he was studying in Japan and he was asked by a Japanese scholar, they heard that the first comfort station was set up in Shanghai, China. Then they asked him whether he knew about it. That's the first time he heard about this. He's a historian in Shanghai Normal University. So he returned to China and started to do research. And to his surprise, in Shanghai alone, right now about 164 sites of formal comfort stations were located.
164 sites?
Yeah, not including some of the sites during the post-war urban development. You know there were some people report there were sites, but it no longer able to identify. Then the research from different locations in China started as a grassroots movement and spread all over China. And then the findings are surprising. Yeah.
So talk about what's surprising to you. And I think one of the surprises was the number of women
right.
that were
yes.
part of this.
Yes. The local women, they were drafted randomly and abused and killed randomly. And there were no written documents, no record. But the local people knew there's a witnesses still alive. And there are also local history. So based on these field work, the researchers put together a surprising number. Yeah.
So it was building upon what was known, so to speak, what was already documented,
yeah.
and then eyewitness accounts or people who knew on
right.
the ground what
right.
was happening. And that's how you came with this number that was almost double, right?
Right,
with the
right.
research from back when.
Yeah. The early estimation is this never accurate count, that. And Japanese imperial forces also destroyed any evidence that can prove the war crime. But the early estimation is based on some research done by Japanese scholar and a South Korean scholar that the overall number of military men during the war is about 3 million. And there was a widely known saying that among Japanese personnel that every 29 or 30 soldiers need one comfort woman. So that gave them an overall estimation how the 200,000 victims were estimated.
When you do the math that way.
Yeah, however, that number didn't count into the replacement rate. Chinese scholar found a very high replacement rate because not that one woman served from the beginning to the end of war, many of them died due to illness and treated, due to abuse, due to killing, and some were managed to escape. So this replacement, although some women may be confined in the comfort station for only several weeks or months, the local woman, because the imperial forces moved, right? So when they moved, they abandoned this woman and to a different place and drafted a different woman.
Were comfort women of generally a certain age? And were they coming from certain areas within the countries?
In the case of Chinese comfort women, it's all over. And the age is, the youngest one recorded is 9 years old. The oldest one is over 50. So it's quite a wide range. But the majority of them were young women or girls. The 12 women whose story told in my book, most of them were kidnapped when they were teenagers. Yeah. One of them called Liu Mianhuan, for example. She was the single child in the family. She was abducted when the soldiers occupied their home village in 1943. The villagers were forced to a place to have a meeting. And then the soldiers pick out the girls from the crowd. She was literally kidnapped in front of her mother's eyes. And she was put in this place near a military stronghold and raped by soldiers during the day and violated by an officer at night. And pretty soon her whole body was swelled and she couldn't sit or stand. She said she had to crawl on the floor if she wanted to go to the latrine. And eventually, her parents sold all their family's sheep to raise ransom. Can you believe that? It's not some of the deniers today say these comfort women were prostitutes making money. In the case of a Chinese woman, many of them were not paid, their family were forced to pay ransom to try to rescue their daughters. Well,
and did this family pay the ransom?
They did. And the military man took the ransom but wouldn't let her go immediately. Eventually, her father begged and say, you know, she's too sick, and he promised to send her back if, you know, they let her go. So then they released her and let her to be carried home. She couldn't walk. She was carried home by a donkey. And they feared that the military would come back to get her again, because they tried to get her out, to say that we'll send her back. So her father dig a cellar and hid her in the cellar. And 2 months later, the soldier did come to get her, but she, you know, escaped the second abduction by hiding.
How did you get in touch with her to interview her for your book?
Yeah, I wasn't have, you know, chance to talk to her directly. My co-authors, Professor Su Zhiliang and Chen Lifei, met her multiple times. She already passed away now. I started research late. But my co-author started in 1993. They recorded interview, and this woman's story also investigated by Japanese legal specialist. Her case was presented to the court, and Japanese court recognized the fact but denied her request for apology and compensation.
Are there any women still alive from the book?
From the book, 12 of them were recorded, only 3 are still alive. They're all in the 80s and the 90s, they're passing away. It's just
shocking.
Really hard. Yeah, the woman, for example, from Hunan province, her name is Tan Yuhua. When she told me about her story, I met her in Shanghai. She talked about how Japanese abducted her when they tortured her father. Her father had a disabled leg, couldn't run fast, so he was caught. So she cried out when she saw that, and the soldiers abducted her. And then she was taken to the comfort station. Her father was forced to do labor, but he couldn't walk very well because the disability, it killed her father. And she just said one word. I still remember her face. You know, she had no emotionless face and say, I lost my father forever.
There was one thing in here that I did want you to address, was that I think it was the being victimized twice.
So the woman, actually, they were victimized at their hometown, home villages. And then when Japanese, you know, moved out, at the end of the war, these women, many of them were victimized by their own patriarchal societies. There was a strong, you know, view from the patriarch ideology that a woman who are raped is dirty, right? If a woman resists rape, they were considered martyr. If they survived, they were considered a disgrace to their family or to their clan or village. That kind of patriarchal ideology is still deeply rooted in many rural areas, even in urban site in China, I think in Korean as well.
You've mentioned a few times that your book ended up, you didn't time it because it took a long time for the research, but it came out when another controversy had come out. What controversy are you talking about?
Oh, in August, there were a retraction of a comfort woman reports by Asahi Shimbun newspaper. Asahi is a leading newspaper in Japan. In the 80s and the 90s, Asahi published a series of articles on comfort women. Some of them cited a former Japanese soldier's memoir, Yoshida Seiji's memoir. The memoir, the person said that he was, you know, a soldier during the war in Korea, and he participated in drafting women by force into comfort stations. But his memoir later on was discredited by researchers. And because of that, the deniers said, you know, see, your reporting is based on this, you know, faked memoir. And all the international criticism of wartime Japan's use for military sex slaves is also based on that. So that's not true, then this need to be overturned. So since that point on, in this, during this fall, there have been many events to deny the existence or the forcing women into comfort stations. Some of the Japanese officials requested the UN reporter to revise their investigation report. There was an investigation report by a UN special researcher based on the interview of a South Korean woman and other evidence. You know, the report defined the comfort women system as a sexual slavery. But now they say, you know, there's no forced drafting of a woman and request her to revise it. Of course, UN denied that. They rejected that request.
How did you feel when you finished?
I feel that I did a little thing, that a very small step to take responsibility for the history. And hopefully the book can have some educational value. I think many Japanese readers, they see that the book is not to disgrace Japanese people. Just like we, you know, commemorate the victims of the Holocaust and the atomic bomb, right? It's not to disgrace American people or German people, right? We see the international community as a whole, and we should all care about the fellow human beings' sufferings. Yeah. I really hope, you know, my intention is not to see this issue as a politics between nation states. I think this fundamentally is an issue about human suffering.
That was Pepe Chu, principal author of Chinese Comfort Women, Testimonies from Imperial Japan's Sex Slaves. Tap water is a luxury, and many around the world do not have it. Anna Vicky, a German medical student, is trying to change this by having wells and water tanks built for Ugandans, with the help of a local non-governmental organization. Natalie Muller reports from Dusseldorf in Germany.
Most of us wouldn't think twice about being able to drink a glass of water whenever we want to. But having clean water on tap is a luxury almost 800 million people around the world don't have. Here in downtown Dusseldorf, a German medicine student is working to change that.
My name is Anna Vicky. I'm 27 years old, and I am the founder of 2H.org, which is a non-profit organization. We try to get people to help and also to raise awareness about water scarcity, especially in Uganda, by building wells and protected springs and water tanks.
In rural Uganda, there are many thirsty communities that rely on streams, storm runoff and open wells. Contaminated water sources that can cause frequent outbreaks of waterborne diseases like diarrhea and cholera. Anna Vicky launched 2A.org back in 2009 when she was 22. She says she shied away from getting involved with a big NGO because she thought starting something of her own would be the fastest way to make a real difference. So she put a call out on social media to find like-minded individuals around Germany. 2AID was born. Next, she began searching for grassroots projects that needed support, and that's when she struck a partnership with UMESCO, a Ugandan NGO working to improve, among other things, water and sanitation in the rural Kabala district. They needed funds to build wells to provide drinking water that was safe. The team of 10 volunteers working all over Germany established a social media presence and started campaigning to attract donors and raise the 4,000 euros needed to build the first well.
I never expected it to happen that fast. We started in July 2009 and built our first well in February 2010 and went to Uganda the first time. In the beginning, we were the first social media non-profit organization. We were called that. Social media, they have a great potential because you can reach so many people with like no work.
5 years on, the young team has raised enough to build 65 wells and water tanks and secure clean drinking water for more than 116,000 people.
We don't like give them help for everything, but giving the access to clean water is like the base, so they don't have to, especially the women and children, don't have to walk for hours and get sick by unclean water, so they can build their lives around that and go to school or learn a profession, and that's important.
For each well, a water committee is appointed from the local community to take care of maintenance. And once a year, the two aid team travels to Uganda to visit each project site.
This is the well now.
Mm-hmm. And whereabouts was that? Which community was that built?
That's Wantima, mm-hmm. is what they're called. I should have a photo of what it looked like before. This is the water source that was used before. The animals go and do their business there. Mm-hmm. And and then people go and fetch their water because there's no other.
The team uses Twitter, Facebook and their blog to document the progress of each well while it's being built.
Hallo zusammen. Wir befinden uns hier in Kigasa.
Das ist eine Wasserpumpe. And this is the water pump at first that pumps the dirty water out.
It's to keep the public up to date and to provide transparency, says Anna.
Heute ist der vierte Tag unserer Projektreise in Uganda.
100% of donations go towards the wells, because 2Aid has no paid staff and no office space.
We mostly work online. You can see what happens with your money right away, because when we receive donations and we do a project, we always get pictures from the building process and we put them on Facebook and on our website, and so you can see what actually is happening with the money you gave.
That also means tracking the impact on people's lives. Anna also records interviews with the locals who are using the new wells. Here's one doctor she spoke to.
Access to safe water, clean safe water, is a big, big challenge in Africa. Access to piped water is less than 10% of our population. Most people get their water from the rain, from the runoff, from the rivers, from boreholes. And diarrhea is the most common illness and claims many children. It's the third biggest disease in Uganda. Any opportunity to give water to these people is welcome.
It's usually moms and dads who come to us and say that their children don't fall sick that often anymore and they go to school more regularly.
Anna will be travelling to Uganda for a third time at the end of 2014. In between studying medicine and working part-time at a clinic, she's also now on the lookout for projects in other countries that 2aid.org could support.
There are really so many people out there who want to get engaged, and if you give them the opportunity, then you can have so much impact.
This is Natalie Muller for DW in Düsseldorf.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1329.